A monitor is now watching the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. It's just one of the changes after a federal judge ruled the office was racially profiling. But those changes don't come cheap.
This is what it costs to have a sheriff that is this detached, this incompetent.
I'm Mark Brody. Today on the show, the cost of compliance. Plus, organ donors are in high demand, and waiting for a donor can be excruciating. Imagine no wait. Researchers at U of A are working on that. And a Phoenix neighborhood will be getting some new residents, but the ones already there aren't all excited about it.
This particular project, because there is such demand for affordable housing for young people as well, that it just showed to be a little bit of a concern.
Plus, golfing fans descend on Scottsdale, theater goers become actors, and an Arizonan represents in Sochi. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. More than a week of Syria peace talks yields no tangible results. The Syrian foreign minister's assessment today. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Geneva that the government has not yet committed to return for more talks on February 10th.
UN mediator Lakhdar Brahimi called it a modest beginning, but saw glimmers of potential common ground. Syrian Foreign Minister Walid al-Muallam says he will consult with Damascus before deciding to return for more talks. He says there were no results this time because of blatant interference by the U.S., a reference to Washington arming moderate Syrian rebels.
They know that there is no moderate opposition. There are only terrorist organizations.
Syrian National Council President Ahmad Jarba says the opposition gained from standing face-to-face with what he called a murderous regime, declaring that by coming to Geneva, President Bashar al-Assad's government was, quote, walking in its own funeral procession. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Geneva.
The State Department does not appear to be raising any major environmental objections to the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline in a final assessment it released today. As NPR's Elizabeth Shogren tells us, the pipeline, which would carry heavy crude from Alberta, Canada, is controversial because the oil has a bigger greenhouse gas footprint than conventional crude.
The State Department says using what's known as tar sands or oil sands to fuel vehicles produces 17% more greenhouse gases than conventional crude and as much as 10% more than other heavy crudes. But the department concludes that the Keystone XL pipeline would be unlikely to significantly affect the pace of development of Canada's heavy crude. Next, other federal agencies and the public can weigh in, and Secretary of State John Kerry will assess whether the project is in the overall national interest. Carrie Ann Jones is a State Department Assistant Secretary.
This is only one piece of the information that we'll be considering going forward.
Other factors include energy and national security concerns. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
The FBI says the suspicious powder that was mailed to several New York and New Jersey locations near the site of Sunday's Super Bowl does not appear to be dangerous. However, more testing is being conducted. President Obama is challenging corporate America to do more to identify and hire qualified people who've been out of work a long time despite improvements in the U.S. economy.
We've got to do more to restore opportunity for every American. And the opportunity agenda I laid out begins with doing everything we can to create new jobs here in America.
Obama speaking at the White House, where he hosted CEOs in charge of some of the nation's largest companies. They have signed a one-page list of best practices for recruiting people who have been unable to find work for at least 6 months. Before the closing bell, Dow is down 150 points at 15,699. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Hibu, committed to helping businesses get noticed online, especially on mobile phones and tablets. Learn more at hibu.com.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Steve is off caddying for Phil Mickelson this weekend. Well, and they're having some cloudy skies up at the TPC in Scottsdale today. There is a very, very slight chance we could see some rain. Look for a high today of 69 degrees. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows near 50. Partly sunny weekend on the way with highs of 65 degrees each day. In the news this hour, Governor Jan Brewer's office has, within the last half hour or so, received the report from the care team she assembled last month after revelations of more than 6,500 reports of child abuse and neglect that weren't investigated. The panel says the non-investigated cases happened because of systemic failure, a lack of accountability and transparency, and bad decision-making, and calls law enforcement a crucial and underused partner. Among the recommendations the panel put forth, provide investigator training to the child safety specialist that will conduct field investigations and create a standalone agency that reports directly to the governor. Brewer has already started the process of making that happen. Junk food might be getting more expensive across the Navajo Nation. As KJZZ's Tina Sieg explains, the tribal council has approved an additional 2% tax on unhealthy snacks.
That includes pastries, chips, and soda. The 2% tax would be added to the tribe's current 5% sales tax. Revenue from the new tax would be used by chapters to promote recreation and health and would fund everything from community gardens to basketball courts. Sponsors of the bill say they're trying to stem the diabetes epidemic on the reservation. Opponents say the bill burdens consumers. A separate measure also approved would remove the tax from fresh fruits and vegetables. Both bills now move on to President Ben Shelley for consideration. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
When federal courts get involved with local police departments, the price tag can soar. An outside monitor is now in place to ensure that Sheriff Joe Arpaio and his deputies comply with the court order to prevent racial profiling against Latinos. That's just one of many reforms coming to the department, and those changes are starting to add up. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports.
The Maricopa County Sheriff's Office isn't letting reporters come on ride-alongs these days. But Sergeant Chris Dowell agreed to talk with me in his department SUV about how the court order will change the way the Sheriff's Office operates.
The supplemental order is 59 pages. I've read the supplemental order 20 times.
Dowell is part of a small team tasked with the complicated job of compliance. So what's in those 59 pages? For starters, how deputies make traffic stops is changing.
We do not inquire about their immigration status.
Deputies must go through new training to prevent racial profiling and...
Every traffic stop will be documented. It'll be documented, hopefully digitally, if we can get the technology to move along quickly.
The first round of mandatory changes will take effect at the end of March, when deputies will have to record the length and reason for making a traffic stop, as well as their impression of the driver's race or ethnicity. Eventually, deputies or patrol cars like the one we're in now will be outfitted with video cameras, and the department will put a new system in place to monitor deputy discipline and performance. Actually, Dowell is excited about that last bit.
Those are things we wanted to move into, we just didn't have the money for, so now we're going to be able to move into it. This order is going to allow us to move forward a lot quicker than we would have been able to do.
All this at an estimated $22 million for the first year and a half, plus an annual $10 million for the next 5 years. Add to that about $9 million in attorney's fees for the drawn-out legal battle that brought all this on. Given how tight county finances have been lately, it's possible this expense could lead to cuts in other programs. Denny Barney chairs the County Board of Supervisors.
We're all operating from the same checking account. It's the taxpayers' money. And frankly, we're going to continue to work hard to balance doing everything that we're mandated to do from the state.
The court forces them to invest and fix themselves, even if they don't want to.
University of Pittsburgh's David Harris studies court-ordered changes at police departments. He says though reforms are expensive up front, they may prevent more costs down the line, such as lawsuits from people who think they've been mistreated by officers. And Maricopa County Sheriff's Office has had its share of those. Harris says the order has the potential to make one of the country's most controversial law enforcement agencies first rate.
If the leadership of the department and the municipalities it serves have invested themselves in it rather than resisting it, what you will have is a department that will be remade.
I think this is a bargain, $22 million, given everything that's happened.
Randy Parras is one of Sheriff Joe Arpaio's harshest critics. He ran an unsuccessful campaign to recall the sheriff after his 2012 reelection.
This is what it costs to have a sheriff that is this detached, this incompetent, someone who's this incapable of really adopting policies that are within the law.
But in a recent letter to the U.S. Attorney General, Arpaio said county taxpayers shouldn't have to pick up the tab. He says federal agents taught his deputies the very practices that prompted the court's intervention, so the federal government should pay for the reforms. For his part, Parras has his own equally unlikely idea of where the money should come from, Arpaio's campaign chest.
He was able to raise money on these practices of going after Latinos and immigrants. He raised money from a lot of races across the country. We should be able to use that money to pay down this debt.
In fact, just this month, Arpaio announced his campaign war chest got a $3.5 million bump in 2013. That's a new fundraising record for a county politician. Jude Joffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Six nominees to the federal bench in Arizona had their long-awaited confirmation hearings this week. Among the group of potential new federal judges is Diane Humitiwa, who would be the first American Indian woman on the federal bench. Paul Bender, a law professor at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at ASU, says the nominees overall represent a diverse group.
Well, yeah, it is, as compared to the people who historically have been nominated to the federal bench. I mean, if you go back 20 or 30 years, you're going to find almost all white men and, you know, relatively elderly sometimes. Whereas in recent years, I think presidents have been making a deliberate effort to diversify the bench. And, you know, it's not just for show. Issues that come before the federal courts involve all kinds of groups of people. Diane Humitiwa is a perfect example. In Arizona, lots of things before the federal court in Arizona involve Indian affairs. And having somebody there who has experience in that, who knows what it's like to be on an Indian reservation, brings a wisdom to the decision that you don't get if everybody is somebody who is from one background.
It sounds like the diversity isn't just looking at people and seeing what their race or ethnicity is, but also sort of where they come from as far as their legal backgrounds and what they think about and how they interpret the law.
Right, right, exactly. Different experiences, different backgrounds. I think that's a very important thing to have on the bench. It's good to have people on the court who come from less affluent places, people of racial minorities, because those issues about those things come before the court.
Assuming that this group of nominees is eventually confirmed and join the federal bench, what kind of impact do you think having them there will have on cases that go before them in Arizona?
You know, I think maybe the most important thing is people who come before the court may feel that they're getting a fairer shake if they see people on the bench who are like themselves. And if they don't see people on the bench who are like themselves, they may tend to feel that it's an alien institution that isn't treating them fairly. With regard to individual cases, it's very hard to say. You know, how the fact that judges say with Diane Humitiwa that she's American Indian, is that going to affect any of her decisions? Probably not in any specific way. But her understanding of things and her experience, she's been a prosecutor. She's worked for the Senate Indian Affairs Committee. She knows about Indian culture in a way that most people don't. That's wisdom and knowledge she brings not only to cases involving Indians, but to cases involving anything. And that's true of all of these diverse nominees.
Paul Bender is a law professor at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at ASU. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. This is an election year, and elections themselves have been a big issue, both in Arizona, with a controversial law approved last year, which lawmakers are now working to repeal, and nationally, with the Supreme Court ruling invalidating parts of the Voting Rights Act. In his State of the Union address Monday, President Obama brought it up.
The bipartisan commission I appointed, chaired by my campaign lawyer and Governor Romney's campaign lawyer, came together and have offered reforms so that no one has to wait more than a half hour to vote. Let's support these efforts.
That commission's report also holds Arizona up as a model in two areas, online registration and the permanent early voting list. To talk more about that, we called on Doug Chapin. He's the director of the Program for Excellence in Election Administration at the University of Minnesota and was an informal advisor to the commission.
The report isn't really specific necessarily about individual states, but I think it is true that Arizona, as the state with the oldest online voter registration system, has some really important lessons for other states who are either considering or beginning to implement online voter registration in their own states.
It looked like the report also touched on the fact that people who are able to register online tend to vote more, and people who are able to vote early and by mail and not have to sign up each time for an early ballot are more likely to vote as well.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that one of the things that we're just now starting to look at in the field is how people who use online tools compare to voters overall. And early data seems to suggest that people who either register online or check and update their voter records online are more likely to be voters on election day. Now, you know, we don't know which way that goes. If people who are more likely to vote are more likely to use online tools, or if there's some other kind of relationship there. But the truth is that it appears for now that online registration is attracting the kinds of people who then follow through and actually cast a ballot on election day. You see the same thing with the permanent early voting list.
It's kind of interesting that in this report, Arizona is held up as a model in some respects, because elections and how they're held are kind of a point of contention here right now. Last year, as you may know, the state legislature passed a law that basically, among many other things, allows county recorders to clean up the early voting list. And there's a lot of talk here about this is sort of a way of disenfranchising a lot of voters and trying to suppress some kind of turnout. So I think it's interesting that at least in these two respects, Arizona is kind of held up as a model.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of that back and forth as well. And in some ways, Arizona's experience with the permanent early voting list mirrors what other states have seen with registration lists generally. We know for a fact from research that Americans generally tend to be pretty mobile, that the average American, I think, changes addresses up to 7 times in their lifetime. And how registration lists, which can end up having snapshots of that address change over time on the list, how you deal with that can be a real challenge. And so just as you have fights about so-called purges or list maintenance, depending on your point of view, in different states, I think places like Arizona, which have an active permanent early voting list, are facing the same kind of challenges. So figuring out the line between making sure that people who are on the list are still either casting their ballots early or casting votes from that address, and making sure that you're not carrying lots of deadwood on the rolls, which can then increase the possibility for either mistake or bad behavior at the polls, is a balance that every state has to work through.
Doug Chapin is the director of the Program for Excellence in Election Administration at the University of Minnesota. What if patients who needed new organs didn't have to wait for their turn to come up on the organ donation list? Researchers are working to make that a reality. Dr. Zane Kalpi at the U of A Medical School is one of them. He's a cardiothoracic surgeon, among many other things there, and is trying to stop people from dying while waiting for a new heart or lung.
If you have patients who have, say, had a heart attack or are in lung failure from chronic disease, then it's about trying to use novel ways or new ways to try to salvage them. But at the same time, when you have an organ, when the patient really needs a heart transplant or a lung transplant, could we recondition organs which are marginal for improving the donor shortages? And then the last thing would be, you know, the third category would be if we could take your stem cells and grow you a new organ.
How exactly do you do that?
You can do it in three ways. The first way would really, you can take either those hearts and lungs, which you couldn't recondition properly, you would be able to take out all those cells, but just leave the skeleton of the organ. But the secret of that is, if you do that, do you just are you just left with just a lump of a skeleton which has no architecture or doesn't even look like a heart or a lung? So we've devised new ways to try to decellularize, which is removing all the cells, in a much more gentle way with newer ideas and technologies, and then providing a skeleton to allow you to reseed it with your own stem cells. We're building a bioreactor which is capable to do this in three dimensions. Instead of growing it on a Petri dish, which is fairly static, we're building it in an incubator, which has got a total artificial heart spliced in to give it pressures that you and I see every day, so the cells can see stretch and can see the shear forces necessary to simulate microgravity, which is what you would find in space as well as in the womb.
It seems like technology would play a pretty significant role in what you're trying to do here.
It does. And I mean, technology is fascinating, but it's also how you use it. And when you have the whole world of 3D printing coming along, the resolution of the 3D printers hasn't really come to building the 3D microenvironment with utmost perfection. So the idea of building the skeleton is great, but then guess what? If you build it and you have a perfect 3D bioprinter, you still have to cook it outside of the body, and for that you need a bioreactor that makes physiological sense in order for it to become something that you can implant into a patient or transplant into a patient.
Do you think that it's conceivable that at some point down the road, 3D printers will be able to be used to produce at least sort of the building block for an organ that would then have to go and be worked on to make it applicable to put it inside a human body?
Absolutely. It's already been done. So two of my colleagues, one is at Harvard, he's already been able to print out a kidney. And the other chap who's in Wake Forest, and he's already implanted a bladder, which he bioprinted.
What kind of ethical issues do you think that would raise? I mean, if you're able to just sort of produce a human organ on a printer, it seems like that would bring up some ethical questions as well.
On the contrary, it will probably get rid of the black market in organs. And, you know, I really want to focus on pediatric transplantation because it's such an underserved population. And, you know, trying to find a heart for a child is crushing when you can't. It's not perfect. So I think that developing these organs or printing these organs, which have functional integrity with the view to transplanting them, may actually have a positive ethical benefit with appropriate regulation. It really is a remarkable force that could change the paradigm of where we're moving.
Dr. Zane Kalpe with the University of Arizona Medical School. He'll be giving a talk about his work on Wednesday in Phoenix as part of the school's MiniMed 2.0 series. Still to come, lots of people dream of acting, and One Valley Theater is making those dreams come true. Kind of.
Rather than it all being delivered in the same format to each individual, the individual experience becomes a huge part of the storytelling.
Get involved in immersive theater. That's ahead. It's the show. Well, the clouds you see outside right now are likely to stay with us for the rest of the day. Also, look out for some areas of blowing dust today. The National Weather Service has issued a blowing dust advisory until 6 o'clock for parts of central Arizona, including from Phoenix down to Casa Grande, so do be aware of that. We're looking for a high temperature day of 69 degrees. It'll be partly cloudy again for tonight, overnight lows near 50, then partly sunny for the weekend, both highs both tomorrow and Sunday of 65 degrees. Right now in Phoenix, it is cloudy, 68 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Dignity Health, with an online ER waiting service at its member hospitals, St. Joseph's, Chandler Regional, and Mercy Gilbert. DignityHealthArizona.org.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Mark Brody. The idea of robots has been around for quite a long time, and whatever their technological shortcomings, they have been our companions.
Danger, Will Robinson! Danger! No, Will Robinson! Danger!
They've been our objects of romance.
I still find myself having conversations with her in my mind.
Or well-intentioned machines run amok.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Some examples of on-screen robots lost in space, the most recent Her, and the classic 2001 A Space Odyssey, poor HAL 9000. Eric Sofci is with us now, a contributor to Popular Science, including a robotics blog called Zero Moment. He also writes about science fiction for Slate. So what I would love to do is to just, arm in arm, stroll down the corridors of history and really explore a pretty old relationship that humans have with the robots in the movies. What's your earliest robot screen memory?
Oh, for me, I think it was probably R2-D2, which was interesting because I feel like at that time I didn't sort of understand the killer robot sort of trope, which I think has become, you know, pretty dominant. So for me, yeah, that was it. It was him and, you know, C-3PO sort of being essentially comic relief, just sort of goofballs and sort of quietly heroic, even if, you know, they didn't usually get the credit.
And very plausible. I mean, let's hear a little bit from the Rowan and Martin team of robots, C-3PO meeting R2-D2.
Oh, hello. I don't believe we have been introduced. R2-D2, a pleasure to meet you. I am C-3PO Human Cyborg Relations. I beg your pardon, but what do you mean, naked?
It's such a classic. And, you know, it comes from earlier movies. I mean, Star Wars really does owe a debt to movies like Forbidden Planet. Do you remember Robbie the Robot? Let's listen.
Now, tell me, what are your duties here on this planet?
I clean your house. I drive your atomic car. I cook your meals.
Pretty great, huh?
It's amazing. I mean, it's interesting. I feel like, you know, both those movies are kind of an example of a sort of golden age of robots as our friends, at least in movies and that sort of science fiction. But even then, there were kind of inklings of, you know, darker days to come. If you look at the poster for Forbidden Planet, it's very salacious. It's Robbie holding a woman who's sort of unconscious, and he's clearly the bad guy. And it's, you know, there's, again, something kind of lurid about it. But then in the movie, he's an absolute good guy. He actually sort of refuses to hurt people. That's how he's programmed. So it's an interesting kind of disconnect. And again, I think it kind of foreshadowed sort of what was to come, which is this sort of evil robot craze, which I think we're in right now.
And, you know, that really began on some level. I mean, more movie buffs would know the details. But it seems to me that the entire Terminator franchise was really about this tension between are robots good and are robots bad. Here's a selection from Terminator 2 Judgment Day.
Oh, you're like a machine underneath, right? But sort of alive outside?
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
Get a grip, John.
So the robots are going to end the world, but the robots are also going to save the world in terms of...
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like when we talk about robots today and sort of the, you know, the most common tropes, I guess, or sort of, you know, perspectives on them are it all goes back to Terminator and that, you know, essentially an infinite number of them. But the original Terminator movie, I mean, it gave us all of the stuff that we sort of go back to as far as what we're afraid of from killer robots. It's got the sort of humanoid walking around, sort of stalking us, trying to kill us. It's got the drones, essentially. We had this vision of sort of airborne drones that were sort of attacking humans with impunity. So it always goes back to that, even in sort of academic papers about, you know, the sort of risks of armed robots. They'll actually reference the original Terminator movie.
Well, so the question is this, and listen to this, is this redemption?
Earth. Oh.
Now, you and I probably know what that's from, WALL-E, but not a lot of others will. What do you think of WALL-E? It's sort of benign robot.
I absolutely loved WALL-E, and, you know, in part because I am kind of a robot apologist, But I feel like it was this great depiction of robots that were mostly actually good. There's sort of one or two evil robots in it, but all the robots are basically just following their programming, or they're sort of in love with each other, you know, in the case of the main characters. And they don't really care about the humans one way or another. You know, they don't want to control them. They don't really want to rescue them. They just all have their own personal motivations like we do, which I think is a very cool departure. Hmm.
Well, this might feel a little bit out of left field, but we began this hour talking about the human-machine interaction, that it's less about the robot per se and more about how humans and robots work together. I'm thinking of this movie Pacific Rim, where people strap themselves into these robot-like creatures in a brain meld. That's kind of where we're headed with the actual technology right now.
That's kind of what we're hoping. You know, it seems like it's hard to tell how long it'll take to get there, because that interface is very tough. It's very hard to do without actually having sort of an implant in your brain, which obviously is, you know, a pretty daunting prospect.
Although you're ready to do it. You're ready to do it tomorrow, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that is coming. But I think before then, we'll see a lot more sort of a more familiar kind of interactions between robots that'll basically just be like how we interact with people, you know, sort of voice commanded stuff, asking them to do things for you, asking them to sort of help out with certain things. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of research actually heading in that direction, where you don't have to sort of program the robot that you're working with. You can just give it, you know, simple conversational sort of commands. So I think that's going to come first, that notion of them just being sort of companions. And then eventually we'll get to that much more sort of creepy direct brain control.
Direct brain control in all of our futures. Well, you know, it's a long relationship with robots. And thanks for helping us to explore it there in the movies. Eric Sofci, thanks so much.
All right, thanks a lot.
Eric Sofci is a contributor to Popular Science, including a robotics blog called Zero Moment. He also writes about sci-fi for Slate.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. The setup of a traditional play is age-old. Actors perform and you watch. But with immersive theater, those roles aren't so defined. The audience is invited to wander through the piece and maybe even interact with its performers. This approach is popping up in cities across the country, but it's just starting in Phoenix. KJZZ's Stina Sieg recently paid a visit to one of the first immersive shows in town.
Welcome. Can I get your name?
When you arrive at the seven layers of Bastian Bachmann, you're greeted as if this were any other play. Then, immediately, things start to get a little weird.
And then take some glasses and a mask, and the butler will give you instructions when she comes around to collect you.
The butler is a young woman who insists you put on what look like safety goggles and a surgical mask. You follow her to a door outside the historic Phoenix Ice House and get ready to go inside someone's head.
Watch your step in your journey through memory.
Now, you're exploring the mind of Bastian Bachmann, known as BB, a composer with a brain tumor. His mindscape is represented by three floors and seven rooms of this huge industrial space. As you wander upstairs and past concrete walls, you come across scenes running simultaneously. These are BB's fragmented memories.
I forget! Can we not do this now?
You can come and go as you please, but that doesn't mean these vignettes are always easy to watch. Seeing BB fight with a protege in one room and learn about his illness in another is unsettling. Director Megan Weaver would hope so.
The way that he's experienced the world is fragmented and is flawed and strange and has weird, surreal qualities to it, and the fact that the audience has that experience is fitting and intentional.
The play grew out of a design class at Arizona State University a few years ago. Weaver says she and two collaborators combined their interest in neurology, perception, and the mind. And Weaver sees immersive theater as a natural way to convey this blend of ideas.
Rather than it all being delivered in the same format to each individual, the individual experience becomes a huge part of the storytelling.
Another huge part of the story? Music.
Let me poke around.
The voice you hear belongs to Stephen Cass, known in this show as The Doctor. He plays an untethered, glam rock version of an MD, complete with deranged nurses as backup singers. Cass likes this immersive theater thing. He thinks having the audience in his face keeps him on his toes.
You really have to be honest, because if you're just totally faking it, just BSing your way through this, you're going to look like it just awful. You're going to look horrendous, and it's not going to read.
But it does read, and partly because of how personal the actors get. They can pull audience members aside, speak lines directly to them. As Juliana, Baby's angsty daughter, Jenny Strickland sometimes leads people outside the building and promises to show them a secret.
When I was little, I used to come out here.
Strickland says she likes these intimate asides.
You know, having a moment to speak to another person face to face and just recount a story is refreshing.
That's not the type of thing you get with a typical play. Strickland hopes that everyone who comes to the show sees that and isn't afraid to separate from whoever they came with.
And gets to explore theater on their own individual taste and creates their own story from what we've put out in the space.
The Seven Layers of Bastian Bachman runs through Sunday. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News. Phoenix.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is John Longo. I'm the owner of Circle 6 Studios, and we're making pieces here today, Blowing Glass. The process is always the same no matter what you make. You gather some glass out of the furnace, add color to it, make the shape, and put it in the annealer overnight. It's one of those things where you have to enjoy the puzzle more than the product. And if you enjoy the process, then the failures don't mean anything because you're making glass the whole time. One of the biggest things about glass blowing is you don't have very much time to work with it. If it cools down below 800 degrees too quickly, it basically explodes. So it's constantly in this flux, which is also the part that's really cool about it.
That's John Longo blowing glass at Circle 6 Studios in Phoenix. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org. If you want to go really old school in Phoenix, Jim McPherson says there's one place you've got to go.
We're looking at an adobe structure that's here in South Phoenix in the Warehouse District that is one of the oldest remaining adobe structures in the city of Phoenix.
McPherson is board president of the Arizona Preservation Foundation. He and architect Christina Noble have met me at First Avenue and Sherman at the Dupa Montgomery Homestead. The best guess is that it was built in 1885. McPherson says lots of Phoenix's early settlement happened in this part of town since it's close to the Salt River. And he says this property in particular is notable for another reason.
Many people say that this was one of the first historic preservation projects in the city of Phoenix.
McPherson says a group of preservationists in the 40s started raising money to refurbish the building. Christina Noble, who's also a member of Phoenix's Historic Preservation Commission, says the city's Parks and Rec Department bought the property later in the decade and leased it to another preservation group.
And they took care of it throughout the 50s, and they were the ones that actually did a number of renovations that some may find questionable historically.
Like what?
They actually put a concrete floor in there that's not original. You can see some asphalt shingles up on top there. That was also not original. They placed a fireplace on the interior that clearly is not part of a hay or dairy facility. And that was when they thought
Noble says there was talk in the 80s and 90s about tearing the building down, but the Parks and Rec Department, which still owns it, checks on it from time to time to make sure it doesn't deteriorate. And to be clear, the building doesn't look fantastic. There's a chain link fence around it, and McPherson acknowledges it's still somewhat in disrepair. But he says adobe is a unique material and believes the building could be made functional. He cites a similar building in the same neighborhood.
When I last toured the house, we went inside. It was 106 degrees outside. It was cool inside. There's no electricity. There's no air conditioning, but it was cool.
Christina, as an architect, what stands out to you about this building? Or what do you think is kind of cool and worthy of, besides the fact of how old it is, what makes it worthy of being saved?
Yeah, obviously the history just in and of itself is a beautiful story. But no, I think that the Ocotillo roof is definitely a beautiful element. And the wood doors have a unique quality to them as well. And then also how Jim was talking about the adobe is just so native here, literally, and part of the story, right? It's, built from the earth right there on the site. And it just creates a beautiful texture on the walls, and it's just a fantastic building material as well.
What does it look like on the inside?
It starts kind of low, but it has a relatively lofted ceiling, right? Like it's a nice height of the ceilings. And you have the exposed wood on the inside. And there's two small rooms side by side and concrete floors. And when we visited, you walked into the first, and it was much more light because you had the doors open. And then you walked into the second, it was very dark, and you had the dramatic quality of the light coming in through the turret.
From an architectural standpoint, I mean, are there ways that you could, on the exterior, make it so that it's okay for someone to work in there while still maintaining its historical integrity?
I think that you could definitely come up with some unique solutions that help protect the existing building while also preserving that history. On some projects that I've worked on, you sort of design, let's say, kind of like a box within the box. So you keep the existing integrity of that existing structure, and then you kind of protect that, and then you build within it. You could also imagine the reverse, right? Imagine you talk about the sort of glass skyscrapers beyond. Like, what if you just sort of encased it in this perfect little glass box to protect it as well, is another idea.
It is a bit surreal to see this short adobe building with the downtown skyline at the top of your line of sight. Jim McPherson says the building is a valuable asset.
These populated this area so much in the 1870s, 80s, 90s, and here we have one of the few remaining left. And for school children to see this in relationship to what else has developed over time, it gives you an idea of what life was like that you can't get in a picture book, that you can't get in a video.
McPherson says his group is working with other preservationists to try to find money to rehab the Dupa Montgomery homestead. That cash would most likely have to come from private sources. The U.S. women's hockey team plays its first game of the Olympics a week from tomorrow against Finland. And for the first time, the team will feature a native Arizonan. Lindsay Fry of Chandler will be playing in Sochi, and she's pretty pumped up about it.
Obviously so excited. It's going to be my first one. I'm so excited to represent, my family, my friends, and everyone in this country, really. So it's going to be unbelievable, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Do people give you weird looks when they find out what sport you're playing and where you're from?
Yeah, the question I always get is, they have ice in Arizona? it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun to show the world that there is hockey in Arizona, and I really hope to one day come back and help grow it even more.
Now, there's a pretty big rivalry, right, between the U.S. and Canada in women's hockey. So is it hard to sort of look past some of the other countries that you'll be playing and not just look ahead to the matchups with Canada?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose at the back of your mind, they're the ones that you're really thinking about. But, we're just so focused that we're definitely not going to let ourselves not take it one day at a time. I mean, we're going to be focused every second that we're there and, still take it all in. But, definitely one game at a time is going to be our mentality.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about whether or not Sochi is going to be ready for all of you to get there. Do you have any concerns? I mean, is this something that the athletes think about where you're going, or just the fact, hey, it's in the Olympics, I don't really care where it is?
Obviously we're aware of everything that's going on. How can you not be with the media? But, it's out of our hands, it's out of our control, and, we just have to stay focused on what we've been working so hard for all year.
Will your family be joining you there?
Yeah, they will be.
Do you have any concerns about having them there, given what we've heard about the security situation?
We're all in this together, and you know, again, all you can really do is just sort of trust and pray and hope it's all going to be all right. But, you know, we're all aware and we're all really excited.
Lindsay Fry, thanks so much for your time and good luck in Sochi.
Thank you.
It's got a robotic rover driving on the moon, as well as the world's fastest supercomputer. China is emerging as a new superpower in science. It's spending vast amounts on research, so much that one leading British scientist says China is on course to overtake the U.S. in the next 30 years. The BBC's science editor David Shuckman was given rare access to one key area of Chinese research, cloning.
I'm in a giant shed holding 90 pigs in two great rows of pens. It's a very warm evening. They're just starting to settle down for the night. They look normal, but what's really unusual is that each of them is carrying cloned embryos. This place is carrying out cloning on an almost industrial scale. Here in southern China, this company, BGI, produces an astonishing number of cloned pigs, about 500 every year. The technology of cloning itself is nothing new. Remember Dolly the sheep nearly 20 years ago. The difference here is that China is turning cloning into a mass production. A sow breathes heavily. There's an oxygen mask over her snout. She's under anesthetic, lying face up on an operating table. Two technicians are about to implant a batch of cloned embryos. BGI has developed a new way of accelerating this process. The scientist in charge is Dr. Yutao Du.
Actually, it's just the main benefits is the low cost in equipment and the manpower, so that we can do cloning in very large scale, like 30, 50 people working together to do the cloning, so that we can really make like a cloning factory here.
Actually, like a factory?
Yes, yes, exactly.
With cloning?
Yes.
The remarkable sight of a shed full of cloned pigs. Many have had their genes modified. BGI says it follows international standards on animal welfare and ethics in its cloning program. This is one batch of cloned piglets. The scientists here say they're doing this work to improve yields for pig farmers and also because they can give these pigs particular genetic traits which makes them useful for medical research. But clearly, this is one aspect of science that makes a lot of people pretty uncomfortable. A huddle of young researchers around a machine that sequences or reads genes. BGI is not only a global leader in cloning, it also has the world's largest collection of gene sequencing machines. It even bought an American company that makes them. The ambition is to read genes to help improve everything from healthcare to food. And the work must be relevant to ordinary people, says the chief executive Wang Jun. He chooses species to sequence if they have industrial uses or look cute or even taste good.
Forget about all the scientific reasons there. I mean, to have a reason, direct reason, who can impact people's life. I mean, if it tastes good, you should sequence it. You should know what's in the genes of that species there. And we have another category, actually it's useful sequencing, bacteria and things like that.
Genes are the basis of life.
A promotional video portrays BGI and its global vision.
And to BGI, achieving greatness.
This company is a vivid example of the dramatic rise in Chinese science. As this country emerges as a giant of science, the sheer scale of the effort and the lack of public scrutiny will lead to some questions about where China's research will lead.
The BBC's David Shuckman. Well, if you're headed out on the valley roadways this afternoon, do beware of blowing dust. The National Weather Service has issued a blowing dust advisory until 6 this evening for parts of central Arizona, including from Phoenix down to Casa Grande. Only one problem spot right now. It's on the US 60 eastbound in the West Valley. The left lane is blocked at 111th Avenue. We will see cloudy skies for the rest of this afternoon. Very slight chance for some rain, a high of 69. Partly cloudy skies tonight, overnight lows near 50. It'll be partly sunny over the weekend with highs of 65 each day. It's 68 degrees at KJZZ, and this is the show. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. It's a new service that blends everything that makes our world what it is.
KJZZ is supported by Chandler Center for the Arts, presenting Moscow Festival Ballet's Swan Lake January 31st and the Pamathena Unity Group February 23rd. Tickets at chandlercenter.org.
This week, the Phoenix City Council approved a new project for the area of downtown known as Roosevelt Row. The development will include housing for low-income residents 55 years and older, and that's caused some concern among people who already live, work, and play there. Nicole Underwood is the Director of Operations for the Roosevelt Row Community Development Corporation. Her group shares some of those worries.
Overall, voice of the community, they really want to see an inclusive project that supports mixed use, mixed density, and being able to make the most of the plot of land that is available. The project that was selected has 54 units, I believe, that will be there, between 50 to 60, and there is other projects that are part of the RFP, that projects that were proposed that had more units in their proposed projects. So the one that was that one that moved forward seemed to be a little bit lower in terms of what is capable of being housed at that particular lot. So having mixed use, mixed income, and mixed density are definitely principles that the community wants to see, and there is a great deal of concern that some of those areas weren't being supported with this project.
So is the concern that this project won't use the space for the best available purpose?
I think there's a few different elements of the project, that being one of them. Another huge component of this project is the age restriction element of it. It's a 55 and over proposal. And while, you know, us as an organization, we definitely support multiple use of community members being represented in our downtown. That's what makes us, you know, vibrant and lively, and having representation across all ages and races. This particular project, because there is such a demand for affordable housing for young people as well, that it just showed to be a little bit of a concern.
Is there a concern that having a community where the residents, or at least the majority of the residents, are 55 years or older, is there a concern that that will change the vibe of what Roosevelt Row is, what that neighborhood is?
I think that that is the concern of a number of people downtown. But, you know, downtown represents a very broad range of voices. So there's voices on both sides within our downtown that both support the project and say that there are plenty of vibrant senior citizens that would enjoy living in this downtown area. And there's a number of other voices that have a great deal of concern about the community not supporting what downtown, at least this area of downtown, stands for, which is vibrancy, events, loud music, First Friday activities, and so forth. I believe that there is some requirement that will be part of this project that anybody who moves into the development will understand and sign an agreement knowing that they are going to be part of this vibrant downtown. So I think the twist on that, to, you know, put a positive spin, if, you know, this development is indeed moving forward, is to still include, no matter who is going to be in that development, if it was young people or old people, that we are an inclusive community. So we want to really embrace them and make sure that they have access to all the resources and the fun activities that are in downtown.
Nicole Underwood is the Director of Operations for the Roosevelt Row Community Development Corporation.
Nobody but about me.
The Phoenix Open is in its second round today with more events this weekend. The annual tournament draws in hundreds of thousands of visitors each year, making North Scottsdale a high-traffic mess for the weekend. But for many businesses, that traffic translates to more customers. Van's Golf Shop is just down the street from the TPC of Scottsdale, where the crowds are standing on the grass right off Loop 101, where many cars turn off to find a parking spot for the event. VP of Operations Ricky Levy says the location is ideal.
We get a wide range of people from all over the country that come in and know that we sell tickets. We sell them for $5 less than you can purchase them at the gate.
And Levy says it's the tickets that really make a difference in sales during the Phoenix Open weekend. Usually ticket sales are about the same each year, but
this year it's increased. It's increased about almost 20%.
Levy attributes this spike to the good weather. He says last year the rain likely drove away some spectators. Wayne Harrison stands in a parking lot waiting to be shuttled to the course. He's visiting the Valley from Vancouver, Washington. The last time he attended the Open was 5 years ago, and he and his wife were back for the first round yesterday. But Harrison has bigger plans.
I'll visit a few other golf courses and try and play them instead of just watching people play. Probably have to replenish some balls because I have a tendency to lose a fair number of them.
But not to worry, Ricky Levy with Vans can probably help him with that. Would you believe Arizona had a Super Bowl marching band before it had a professional football team? It's considered one of the most respected bands in the country. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us more about it.
They're known as the Pride of Arizona. The University of Arizona Marching Band has been performing at national events for years, including at President Jimmy Carter's inauguration in 1977. Did you know the U of A band performed at Super Bowl I in 1967?
At this time, the University of Arizona band was under the direction of Jack Lee. And in the world of marching bands and college bands, Jack Lee was a very prominent figure.
Jay Reese is the U of A band director.
He was very well known, and the band was very well known around the country as being one of the finest marching bands in the college ranks.
Super Bowl I was held on January 15, 1967, at the Los Angeles Coliseum. Reese says producers decided to create a halftime show for the new football event. The obvious decision was a marching band performance. After all, it is football. The University of Arizona was asked to be the headlining act. The sounds you hear are from a recording made of the Super Bowl I halftime show. That's the University of Arizona marching band at the start of the show. They're entering the field and performing the Sound of Music. The band performed about a dozen pieces of music that afternoon. With each new song, the orchestra moved about the field, creating new displays, from the OK Corral gunfight to a cracking Liberty Bell. They even formed two giant football players running to kick a giant football. The event ended with the Grambling University Marching Band joining the U of A on the field, creating an outline of the continental U.S. Again, the sounds you hear are a recording from that 1967 halftime show. Band director Reese says he was not surprised when in 1996, the University of Arizona band was invited to perform at the first Super Bowl in Arizona.
The U of A band again was involved in the Super Bowl activities. We played on the Today Show and at the pregame festivities and some things like that. So there's a history between the U of A band and the Super Bowl that continues.
You know that map formation I mentioned earlier? It has become a U of A band trademark. In honor of the 1967 performance, Reese added the U.S. outlining march to the 96 Super Bowl festivities while playing America the Beautiful. And ever since, it has been part of the pregame performance at all the Wildcats football home games. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
We always want to know what you know. Let us know what you know. Send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org. This year's Oscar nominees for short documentary debuted today at the Harkins Valley Art in Tempe. KJZZ's Nick Blumberg tells us about one of them.
Cave Digger is about a very unusual artist in northern New Mexico.
Sometimes I feel more like an archaeologist uncovering something that's already there. It's pretty down and dirty work. I've tried to tell young guys, you could do this. You could have a cave of your own. It doesn't register.
That's Rob Paulette from the film's trailer. He quite literally digs caves out of sandstone cliffs. Documentary filmmaker Jeffrey Karoff first learned of Paulette's work when he and his wife met a couple after buying a home in New Mexico.
And they said, we're having a cave made on our property. So we thought, well, what is that about? They said, well, come and take a look. You're going to be surprised. And that was an understatement.
Karoff describes the walls of the caves as being hand-carved, covered in organic shapes.
A lot of the caves actually have sculptural details on the walls. But the way in which the cave comes together is almost womanly.
Paulette's made 14 caves over the last 30 years. Karoff's film covers the sculptor's process, which is about two-thirds digging out the caves and one-third carving the walls. It also touches on his occasional disagreements with patrons who hire him to build a cave, which Karoff says can be a bit bemusing.
He's the only guy who's ever made caves for the sake of art. And yet, when people commission these works, they have an opinion about how long they should take or what they should look like. And I sort of wondered, where did you form those opinions? Based on what? And Ra himself says, if I could compare myself to the guy down the street, then I would have a way of determining whether I'm too slow or too demanding, but I'm the only guy doing it.
At 67, Paulette doesn't think his body will let him do it much longer. Right now, he's working on a magnum opus, a series of 10 caves. Jeffrey Karoff's documentary Cave Digger, along with the four other Oscar nominees, are now playing at the Valley Art on Mill Avenue. Nick Blumberg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Thanks so much for listening to the show today. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Mark Brody. Steve Goldstein will be back next week. News is next. It's 3 o'clock.